having a great time with Christopher Dunn, looking at some of the magnificence in Egypt. And we're at the Luxor Temple and huge statues. And the idea, again, of an ellipse, it's always been one of my favorite shapes, the ellipsoid. And in writing, we have the three dots called an ellipse. I'm not quite sure why, but it's a very special shape.
Indeed. And it's used in manufacturing, too, quite a bit. In fact, a tail cone for a jet engine would be shaped like an ellipse.
Very good. All right, so we are down now. Look for the black and white picture. That's the last one we stopped at, which has an ellipsoid drawn upon it. If you want to go back up a couple, you can see these are the we're calling these crowns.
This is the white crown of Upper Egypt.
Wow. And these were all knocked off, and they fell to the ground. I assume that somebody propped them upright again.
Yeah, and positioned them so they would be on display. I'm not sure if they were positioned in front of their owners or not, but they're certainly very impressive. And they're different shapes, and just the effort of actually having to manufacture one of those, you do.
I can't understand.
How they did it, because you couldn't do it on a lathe.
No.
We know the Egyptians had lathes, but these wouldn't have been manufactured on a lathe.
How could it have been done? You're an engineer. How could you do this?
Well, today we would do it on a CNC mill and
right.
machine it. We would design it in a computer and apply a tool path to the design, and then send it out to the machine and machine it, and then polish it. But you can't see any tool marks on these pieces, though. That's the thing.
No,
and makes them so interesting.
What do they weigh, Chris?
I'd say probably about some of them are about a ton, between a half and a ton. But they're not light by any means.
No.
You can see the people who are actually standing close to them. On that one photograph,
right,
where there's a line of three of them there.
Let me take you for a minute out of Luxor and go back, and I don't know where it is, but the underground location that has these enormous blocks that have been brought down there and placed in that underground, I can't call it a temple.
Are you talking about the Serapeum?
Exactly.
Yeah. Yes, that site is very interesting, too. I mean, it's quite an amazing facility. I first visited there in 1995, and it was actually closed to the public at that time. And I had been invited to Egypt to participate in a documentary with Graham Hancock and Robert Pavel, John Anthony West, and it was being filmed by Netherlands Television. So they invited me over there to interview me in the King's Chamber, and that was quite an experience. But after the filming, they were heading down to Saqqara and the Serapeum, and another traveler who was there independently and I got a taxi and went to the Serapeum to accompany them. And they, of course, were off in a different area doing their filming. And I jumped down into one of the crypts. And what you have at the Serapeum are these passageways, tunnels cut into the bedrock. Everything is underground. And in these tunnels are these vaulted crypts that are cut into the walls. And there is a step down of about, I'd say, 3 feet. And then they brought in these gigantic boxes. The boxes weigh about 70 tons.
70 tons, 140,000 pounds per box brought right. down through a hallway or an inch. They could barely get those down the hallway.
And that is one of the, of course, one of the mysteries and one of the questions that everybody asked was, you know, there's not enough room for a bunch of workers pulling on ropes. How do they get into a
no, no.
space?
No, no. You have to neutralize, somehow, you have to neutralize gravity as an impediment. You have to. You have to float them in there. There's just no other way. I don't understand anybody who could come up with an argument that would make that viable. I don't know how. You've got to somehow come up with a new physics. Maybe like...
Okay. Yes, like, I mean, I absolutely agree with that. And hopefully one day that mystery will be solved. And, you know, we talk about Coral Castle and Edley
yeah.
Scanlon and what the work he accomplished. And I think it's, you know, when he said that he knew how the pyramids of Egypt were built, uh-huh. I believe him.
Yeah,
because
yeah.
of the way, you know, what he actually created in his lifetime with extremely large blocks of stone. I mean, the guy only weighed about 100 pounds and he was lifting a 30-ton block of stone, 28
yeah.
tons, 25
yeah.
tons,
yeah.
you know,
yeah.
not just one of them, but a lot of them, hundreds of blocks in his castle.
So, I that man was amazing, and he took it
yeah.
with him. He took it with him. Now, if you were Ed Leedskalnin, Chris, to truth
right.
here, would you take it with you, or would you tell somebody?
You know, it's hard to say, because I didn't live in his day, and, you know,
yeah.
he came from the Baltics. He was a Latvian,
mm-hmm.
and there was a tremendous distrust of government.
Well, he was ahead of his time, wasn't he?
There was also a mindset back in the old days where...
Yeah.
you know, techniques and methods that were developed within families or held it within guilds,
uh-huh.
they were held a secret.
They were sacred.
That was,
yeah.
Yeah, that was their power. That was that assured them continued work because they were the only ones that knew how to do a certain thing. And so that was a very strong mindset. And, you know, that mindset is it still...
Understand. Very good point. Yeah.
Yeah. It still goes on today, but I'm sure, you know, that he had his reasons. Maybe I think actually my personal feeling is that he left enough behind that the right person comes along would be able to figure it out how he did it.
Chris, did you not see the book that he wrote or assembled and left behind? And on the cover of the book, and I sorry, I cannot remember the man who figured this out, but he claims to have been able to decode Leedskalnin's secret. And it had to do with, I'm going on memory now, so be easy on me, folks. On the
okay.
cover of that book were three little, I'll call them squiggles. They look like snakes.
Oh, two, I know which one you were talking about.
And there's a gentleman who took those and did some phenomenal work with extrapolating on what those three, I believe there are three little squiggles, what they meant. And it's a kind of a nonsensical thing to appear on the cover of Ed's book. And he said,
mm-hmm.
this is the secret. And he produced all kinds of amazing geometrical pictures explaining why and how these worked. But it didn't necessarily explain how the stones were moved, but it was a key to a lot of the energetic principles that had to be involved with his work. And I can't remember the gentleman's name, and I'm sorry because he used to write to me ever since the crash. I don't remember things so well. But he really did a great job with it. I'll find his name. I'll figure it out. Anyway.
Yeah, I'm not sure either. The guy I know who was really intensely interested in Leedskalnin and... I think he was from Australia. This guy wasn't Australian, was he?
I don't think so. I'll find out.
I think Jeremy Stride, I believe his name was.
No, that wasn't
it. But anyway, yes, that book is called A Buck in Every Home. And it's a very odd book. and it's written, I think it's a metaphor for how he actually performed the work. And there's some code in there. That if somebody would figure it out and replicate the technology, we could move forward a lot faster than we do.
Yep.
But interesting topic, though, Coral Castle.
Oh, it is.
It always comes up.
Did you ever go down there and give it the once over?
Oh, I did. I gave it once over, twice over, three
uh-huh.
times over.
Uh-huh.
I've been down there maybe four or five times, and one time I spent a whole week down there.
Oh, my. Yeah. What did you think of the device in the ground with the shaft that was turnable? Round and around it goes. What did you make of that?
The wheel?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. That's an interesting device. One of the first questions I had was, was it magnetic? And
ley lines, energy, something.
Well, there's been a lot of discussion about, it being associated with ley lines. In fact, a lot of people
right.
think that when he first moved to Florida, he was seen to be going around southern Florida with a steel rod. Sticking it in the ground.
Dowsing, so to speak, yeah.
Possibly, there could be another reason for it, that he wanted a supply of stone, and he didn't want to move much topsoil to get to it. In that area, there's very little topsoil. It's only maybe half an inch or an inch of topsoil.
Do you remember the guy, and I'm going to guess his name, I think his name was Stubblefield, and he was able to stick metal rods in the ground and pull electricity out of the ground and powered up dozens and hundreds of lights at night. You know the name Stubblefield? Am I making any sense? Let me find it. I'll send
familiar,
it to you.
This is a big story. I don't know the story.
I'll get it to you. It's very big. Big story. All right, let's go back to our Luxor tour here. We're to another black and white photo with two ellipsoids drawn over a statue's head.
Right.
What are we looking at here?
The two ellipsoids?
Yeah.
Essentially, I drew them because I wanted to know, as I sensed that the frontal view of the crown showed that it could be an ellipsoid. I wanted to see what a profile view or the side view would look like with an ellipse. And so it turns out that the ellipse fits fairly nicely on the side view too, which led me to speculate in my book that they were modified ellipsoids, a good part of it.
Uh-huh.
But not complete ellipsoids. They're like bowling pins, only tilted back.
Mm-hmm.
So they're not stood up straight. If you take an ellipse and just kind of hold it at an angle, as you can see on that side view, that's how the things appeared or were manufactured.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right.
So,
next.
The next one, we come to the face-to-face with Ramses, and this is a head that had evidently broken from the top of the body and landed below. There's some damage to it. It is without the crown, as you can see. But the interesting thing about the face, as I had actually detected the symmetry on the crowns, I of course speculated just how precise and how symmetrical the faces were, because I related it back to the first time I went to Egypt in 1986, and I was at the Ramses Museum at Memphis. And at the Ramses statue at Memphis, as I was looking down the length of it,
uh-huh.
from the feet to the head, and it's laying down, it's not standing up, and you can view it from a mezzanine that goes around. But the looking down the length of it, I noticed that the nostrils were exceedingly symmetrical, which is very unusual for a human face. Most humans.
Oh, they're asymmetrical. Every face is different.
Their nostrils are not symmetrical.
No, and you look at, if you want to have fun, friends, look in the mirror and take a piece of paper or a piece of cardboard, a straight line, and put it right down the middle of your nose. Look at one half of your face and then reverse it and look at the other half of your face. You'll see two different people.
Yes.
Not the same.
Right. Because your face is not identical from one side to the other.
No.
Exactly.
Well, unless your name Ramses.
I was fascinated with Ramses because I could see that there was some symmetry in the nostrils. And that kind of stayed in my memory so that when I, in 2006, I was photographing the Ramses, the bust on the outside of the temple. And it was, because it was accessible, the Ramses, seated Ramses on the inside of the temple, were, you couldn't get really that close to them because they're about 20, 30 feet up in the air. But these, this one was on the ground, how convenient. If you go down to the photograph below the color photograph, there is an image there. It was taken during the day, so you don't have the, you know, the atmospheric lighting, but it gives you a better photograph or better resolution or more clarity in the consistency of the lighting around the face for examination purposes. And what I did, I tried to take a photograph that was right down the central axis, that's kind of so that the material, the center of the nose and the center of the eyes, the center of the jawline, were in alignment. And I did the best I could, and I came up with, this is probably one of the best, the best aligned photograph that I got. And I took hundreds of photographs at different, mm-hmm. you know, even positioning mm-hmm. my camera very, very slightly after each shot.
To try to get it straight on.
It straight on, yeah.
Uh-huh.
And so this one came up, and it seemed to be the best one that I could find. And so I took the image.
Uh-huh.
I made a copy of it. I flipped it horizontally and made a transparency, laid it on top of the original, and brought the features together, like, and so you can see where the jawline matches perfectly, the nose, the eyes. There is some variations in the headdress, obviously, as you can see.
But look at the circles, the yellow circles around the eyes, the eye sockets, the cheekbones. Wow. The nose, the eyes, the cheeks. Now, this is, again, this is a composite photo we're looking at, correct?
This is, yes, a transparency of the same photograph, only uh-huh. it's in reverse.
Got it.
And so what we're doing is we're comparing one side of the face to the other
mm-hmm.
by laying it over the other one and matching the jawline. And then examining other features of the face.
That's almost scary. It's so precise.
And when you get a little deeper into examining it and looking at it, there are some things that started to dawn on me that weren't immediately apparent. And one of the things was the shape of the mouth, and I was looking at the shape of the mouth, and he has a really exaggerated smile, and I wondered what the reason for that was. And then it occurred to me that because this was a face or a head that was going to be mounted, it was going to be about 20 feet up in the air, when you're looking up at it, if it didn't have that exaggerated upturned lips, it would look like it was frowning at you, or the lips would be downturned.
Oh, very good point. You got it. Very interesting.
Right. So it's a little visual compensation in the carving there. And,
so this was all thought out in advance. That's incredible. This face, again, this head was supposed to be up. Where again?
Mounted on one of the statues.
Uh-huh.
I don't know exactly which one, I would probably think it was one of the seated statues that had lost its head. Imagine losing your head at Luxor.
No. What's amazing to me is that how long these things have been there, and yes, they've been damaged and vandalized,
right.
But thank God not worse. These are some of the most incredible treasures of humankind on the planet.
They certainly are, and you know, and as you said, they've been there for thousands of years, and the precision and the brilliance still shines through. It's still evident on it. That's not to say that the entire carving is perfect and symmetrical, but
right.
it does seem that they had to craft the face. Every face has had to look the same and have the same geometry and the same features. And that turns out to be the case when you examine other statues of Ramses. But there's some very interesting features on this, and when you actually pull out the main features of the face, and if I made a line drawing, I did a line drawing of the face. I've got one in my book, a line drawing of the main features of the face. It looks like a cartoon figure, you know, and because it looks so perfect. Now the geometry is very interesting. If you go down to the following photograph, the other question in my mind is, you know, to attain that kind of symmetry and that kind of perfection, what kind of geometric protocol were they following? You know, like how did they lay out the design of this face? Mm-hmm. You know, what elements did they use to pass the information on from the designer to whoever was actually creating it, whether it was a worker roughing it out in the quarry, or somebody in a machine shop on a machine, or designing it, building a model to actually create the thing. And what I focused on the mouth, because that was a very significant, that was a unique feature.
That is projecting emotion. The rest of the statue is rather stoic. The eyes slightly, but the mouth is projecting emotion, correct?
Yes, it's telling us something. And, you know, so the question in my mind, what's it telling us, besides the fact that it wants to look benign when it's sitting on about 20 feet up in the air and not severe, you know, it's a kind, gentle-looking representation of whatever pharaoh or god that they, you know, the ancient Egyptians worshipped at that time.
Right, that's remarkable. We have to pause again. I have a question when we come back. When we, all of us humans, look at other people's faces, they are not symmetrically perfect like this statue. And I wonder if there's some kind of a subliminal psychological reaction to seeing, gazing into the face of something that is utterly perfect on both sides, because we know that's not how we are. And I'm wondering if it has some kind of an impact on us. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, that's a good question.
That perfection. All right, we'll be back in just a minute with Chris as we continue. Just fascinating material. Okay, and we're back. I had this gentleman on the program a number of times, Chris, and we talked all about the Coral Castle, and his name is John Depew. And I will send you some links that let me know after you go through them. I think you'll find them to be very interesting. You may disagree,
okay,
but
you.
John was I don't know if he's still around. I assume he is, but an extremely brilliantly constructive thinker about this whole thing. And I'm he got that book, and there were three little lines on the front of it, and he did something with those three lines that you will see. That's pretty amazing. All right.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway. Okay. So we're going back to look at Ramses, who I wonder, in Hollywood, a Class A cinematographer and lighting director, I wonder how they would feel coming up with a face of such perfection. How's that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the task involved, it would be it would stretch, you know, it would stretch any machine.
That would be wild. Yeah,
abilities to create. And I had in the course of writing my book, I communicated with a sculptor who sculpts out of different kinds of stone. His name is Mike Leckie. I believe he lives in Oregon, but he's made some beautiful pieces. And I asked him what his opinion was. I sent him a copy of my manuscript for him to review it. And he came back and he said he doesn't have enough time in one lifetime to actually craft one of these things. You know, he'd have to upgrade all his tools and he'd have to be using
one Ramses head like that.
And,
yeah.
But to use you know, simple tools, it would be impossible to create them. And then, of course, to be able to craft the surfaces of the face, which when you look at it, it appears that the face itself was a totally separate task to perform, because this is where the appearance comes out and the symbolism and the geometry of the face comes out.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have a combination of surfaces that it almost appears like they're primitive solids that are combined to create all the different curves. And it's a very simple face, really, because, you know, the general face, like we were talking, if you would scan a normal face or a head, you would have lots of nooks and crannies that you would have to account for.
Sure.
And then the difference from one side to the other, you know, but in this one, it's almost like they use the least number of curves or surfaces or combination of surfaces to create this overall effect. And so, you know, when we look at it and ask, well, how did they do it? And, you know, they obviously they were able to do it, analyzing the geometry of it, analyzing the precision of it, and then,
yeah,
you know, getting into, you know, looking at some of the tool marks that were left behind, a picture begins to emerge of a much more advanced methods. And, you know, we constantly talk about, well, where are the machines? And, you know, in the simplest terms, you have flat surfaces, you know, which are two-dimensional surfaces. You have flat surfaces in the boxes in the Serapeum,
uh-huh,
you know, the boxes in the pyramids, and
yeah,
and then you go to a more sophisticated shapes in some of the artifacts that you can find on the Giza Plateau, and then you come down, you look at the architecture in the Dendera Temple, and it becomes even more sophisticated because some of those simple two-dimensional surfaces are combined with other basic shapes like lines and radii to create, you know, more complicated forms. And then when everything comes to the Luxor Temple, where you get the most extraordinary, sophisticated geometries that are crafted with the same kind of precision that they crafted the simple structures. And it's like, it's almost like peeling an onion, you know, and each layer that you pull off, like the onion, more is revealed. And digging deeper and deeper and examining it closer and closer. So in this, the one drawing where you have the circles and lines, the shape of the mouth is actually, the geometry of it is actually a 3-4-5 triangle. And that is a Pythagorean triangle. So using that, I created a Pythagorean triangle grid, and then created circles that matched the different features of the face, such as the bottom lip, where the lips joined, the eyes, the bottom eyelid, top eyelid, the eyebrow, and all of these features tend to correspond, or they have some correspondence to each other and the grid. So that was amazing kind of revelation to me to see that. Now, you know, everything can be argued to be a coincidence, because I may be seeing something in here that was not intended. This is my creation.
Sure.
But nevertheless, you have to argue, and I would argue strenuously, that they were using some design methods in order to create these. And if not this one, then another one equally as sophisticated and remarkable. Now, one point that I wanted to make earlier, when we talked about the stability of the statues, and obviously this one broke off, but... Mm-hmm. The statue would have been much more fragile if it didn't have the headdress and it didn't have the beard.
Did this statue head of Ramses fall, or was it never put in place?
I think by the features of it, it was actually broken. And because when you look at the first photograph, you can see where the separation occurred. So it was attached to a body at one time. It wasn't crafted as just as a bust to sit individually. but anyway, so we have the headdress provides a gusseted support for the neck, as does the beard. So you have that strengthening of the statue around the neck, which would be a weak point if it didn't have those features in it. Anyway, so of course, after finding that, I had to know if other statues in other parts of the country or the world had displayed the same kind of symmetry and accuracy, and I knew of a statue at the British Museum in London, and this one came from the Ramesseum, which is on the west bank of the Nile. And it's housed in the British Museum. I took a photograph of it and did the same examination. And as you can see in the following black and white photograph, the overlay is remarkably precise.
Well, I don't see, I see no variation at all.
No, I know. I mean, actually, on closer examination, this particular face is more accurate than the one at Luxor. As far as the dimensionally, it appears to be more accurate. Mm-hmm. If you go down to the photograph below that, you'll see the dimensions that were I put in that. Well, the computer came up with those. I did not center the line. If I'd have centered the line, In the philtrum or the center of the nose, the dimensions on the left would be less than the ones on the right. But the explanation for that, as I explain in my book, is that the head itself would only have to turn slightly, and that line would be dead center of the nose, because what you have is a point that is closer to the camera with the nose and the lips than the jawline. And so the jawline would stay still while you rotate the nose to align that.
Are these representations of real beards, or are they stick-ons?
That's a good question.
They don't look natural. They look like they're in some kind of a costumed affectation. They're too stylized.
Yeah, they do. And I think that for the purposes of these statues, maybe they were added just to strengthen the neck.
Right.
Maybe, you know, later on people adopted that look.
Yeah. If you look behind, ladies and gentlemen, behind the beard, you can see it is attached to the upper chest and throat area. It gives it much more strength. Yeah, physically.
Right, exactly.
That's it. That face.
It doesn't look like it's a regular, a normal beard.
No,
it?
I haven't seen many like that. No. In fact, I've seen none like that. Not even ZZ Top. let's see. This statue, though, the face does elicit or emote a reaction. It's a very benign, benevolent, kind of a godlike face. With a slight smile, you can read a lot of emotion into that smile if you spend time looking at it, which you have, I'm sure.
Many hours on the computer and actually at the temples and in the museum. Combinations, probably hundreds of hours working with
it. That is utter perfection, and it reflects the antithesis of the human form, the human shape. We're not perfect like that. That's perfect. They did that for a reason. I don't know why. I couldn't even guess. But that's no accident that is so perfect.
Yeah. Well, you know, there is a saying, and it was actually crafted on one of the statues at Karnak, Ozymandias, it was written by Siculus, one of the Greek philosophers. Unless you know, if you want to understand me, you have to replicate my work. For those, it's basically, you know, that's the only way you can understand what's going on is try and repeat what I did here. King of kings am I. If you want to know my work,
very interesting.
Repeat my work.
This is a Greek.
I have a chapter in my book, The Lost Technologies of Ancient Egypt, and it's called The Ramses Challenge. And really, that is the best way to know, to get in touch with ancient people, is to truly and honestly give them credit for what they did and how they did it by repeating it. And as long as people have been theorizing about how the Egyptians built the pyramids or crafted these statues or cut holes in hard granite very efficiently, nobody has been able to actually replicate the more difficult aspects of the work. But that's because the mindset is that the ancient Egyptians were less advanced than the Greeks or the Romans, and essentially the ancient Egyptian toolbox does not, you know, contain the tools necessary to make these things, and they don't even, I mean, just the tools to cut them, they don't have the instruments to measure them either. And unless you can accept that that's the case and start to come up with more reasonable solutions.
Right.
And to do that, you have to move into the 19th, 20th century, 21st century now, to look for technologies that we have available or have had available in our modern history that are capable of doing this work.
No, and remember, there are no, other than the hieroglyphs, which show a few very, very intriguing things, there are no relics of ancient machinery like the Antikythera mechanism. You'd think that there'd be something, some piece of iron or steel or some kind of metal left behind that would suggest something of nothing. Nothing.
Nothing. Right.
Just the sands of time. That's all that's there.
But even as we're looking at the perfection of the face, they weren't perfect. I mean, they made errors. There were errors in the manufacturing process. If we go scroll down to the photograph below, the ones that with the measurements on it. What happened here was the tool that they were using to cut the lips had gouged out the corner of the mouth and undercut it severely, and in order to remove that a part of the mistake, they cut the lips deeper, and you can see the very sharp cusp where the vermilion border meets the lips and the philtrum.
Right.
A very, very sharp cusp.
Right. That wasn't the original intent then. So
no,
they had to cover up.
No, it was a mistake, and I would probably guess that they'd already cut the lips. They were over in the corner of the mouth. Maybe the piece moved, or the the statue moved, or the machine messed up, or maybe a tool came loose and just gouged into it.
Somebody paid for that one, right?
Well, they got it to the point where, I mean, considering how high it was going to be in the air, people on the ground probably wouldn't notice it.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I didn't notice it until I started to examine my photographs, in my computer, when you're using, these modern digital photograph cameras with high resolution. You can zoom in on areas and see things that you... that would normally escape you if you're just passing by an object.
Even in the one in the British Museum, how large is that one, approximately? The Ramses statue in the British Museum.
That is reputed to come from the Ramesseum, and that statue is reputed to weigh about 1,000 tons.
And that's in the museum.
Sure,
so that's awfully big. How
it's,
tall?
It's
how tall
big,
is it?
Yeah. Sorry.
How tall?
The original height, I'm not exactly sure, but as they have it mounted in the museum, it's about, I would say, 20, 25 feet tall.
It's got to be a very imposing thing to come across. And I'm trying to. Process the emotion in the face.
Yes, I mean, you notice you don't, because I'm below the statue now.
Yeah.
The mouth isn't as exaggerated in the smile. It's kind of the lips have kind of flattened out.
Even the eyes are kindly.
And the eyes actually look down. If you look at the
I see. The whites are
above.
Yeah, yeah.
You can see that the eyes are actually pointing down.
They were looking down at those looking
They're
up.
Looking down at you, and you're receiving a blessing as you pass by.
Very interesting. Fascinating. I've never studied this at all, and just even having this hour or so to look at these. It's just extraordinary.
Well, I really appreciate your excitement at them because...
Oh, they're great.
I know they certainly inspired me. I was on a tear back in 2007, 8, 9, and 10, and getting the book published in 2010,
Right.
This is...
You have another
one
book?
Of those things in the book that I really haven't been out talking about it. It was like after the book was published, I took a sabbatical.
Yeah. I remember you were kind of absent for a while.
Yeah.
Had things to do. Now, are you going to do another? You going to do another book, Chris?
Yes, I am. I have a tour coming up in March, and so after I get back from that tour in Egypt, I'm going to start writing a sequel to the Giza Power Plant, which I've had many requests to write a sequel to that.
No, oh, by all means, yeah. Would you let me know when you get back if we don't talk? I'd love to have you back on the program to discuss what you've seen, what your new observations are, and all that. These are really hard to overestimate. I don't think you can, the importance of this kind of a construct. Just amazing.
Yes, it's very, I think, very significant.
Yeah, yeah. All right, my friend, thank you. Great to talk with you as always, Chris. You take care, be well.
Very
and,
good to talk to you too, Jeff. Thank you so much.
Oh, my pleasure. All right, talk
you
again.
Take care now.
Thanks.
All right.
Christopher Dunn, and an amazing field of endeavor. All right, we'll be back tomorrow night. Talk to you then.